Welcome to the America's Workforce Radio Podcast, the flagship production of the American Workers Radio and Podcast Network, where organized labor and its never-ending fight to protect the rights of the American worker come first. Now, presented by LIUNA, Laborers International Union of North America, here's your host, Ed Flash Ferens.
Labor releases death on the job, the pandemic's toll on American workers. How many employees at Amazon affected? The latest on the stimulus. I guess we can't trust a person in power on steroids. And today on the show, the president of the NFL Players Association and the latest from the United Auto Workers. Good afternoon and welcome to the Thursday, October 8th edition of America's Workforce, where we are available on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, iHeartRadio, as well as Spotify. Also on Facebook, AWF Union Podcasts, and you can follow us on Twitter, AWF Union Podcasts. We have two guests on the show today, and I am very pleased to report that one of them is J.C. Treader, a Cleveland Brown. He plays center for the Cleveland Browns. More importantly, though, he is president of the NFL Players Association. That's right. He was elected into that position in March. And I'll tell you, of all times to be elected to be a top union rep, you know what happened in March? We had the shutdown in the state of Ohio and a big chunk of the country, and affected virtually every sports team, whether it's high school, college, the NFL, the NBA. Everybody was affected by this. Little background on this guy, really interesting. He grew up outside of Buffalo, New York, and he went to Cornell University. I don't know if you know much about Cornell. If you get an opportunity, just Google it and find out what they're all about. They are into labor and labor relations. Their mission, and this is posted right on the school's website, as the preeminent educational institution in the world focused on work, employment, and labor, we are dedicated to generating and disseminating knowledge that improves the lives of workers and transforms the future of work. This is an institution that was founded right after World War II, 1945, and it was founded as the New York State School of Industrial and Labor Relations. Today, it's known as Advancing the World of Work Through Teaching, Through Research, and Outreach. And J.C. graduated from Cornell. He got a very good worldwide view of what workers do and what labor unions do. And he's bringing that to the table of the NFL Players Association. So we'll talk about his background, and we'll talk about getting elected to that position, how difficult that was, and what he sees ahead. Number one, of course, you had the pandemic, and they just reached agreement on a 10-year collective bargaining deal, and he'll get into specifics on this. 10-year deal, and then boom, you got all these players getting sick. So they had to do some changes. He'll talk about that. The other part of the story, artificial turf. And I've heard this for years from players complaining about knee injuries, all kinds of injuries, lower extremities. And apparently the good news is they're finally collecting some data on this. And if you want to change something, you need some scientific evidence in order to move the needle in the right direction. And according to that data, players have a 28% higher rate of non-contact lower extremity injuries when playing on artificial turf. Of those injuries, players have a 32% higher rate of non-contact knee injuries on turf, and a staggering 69% higher rate of non-contact foot and ankle injuries on turf compared to grass. So right now, because of that data, the NFL Players Association is trying to pressure the owners to say, you know what, let's get rid of it. Let's get rid of it. Some stadiums have done that. The Cardinals and the Raiders have figured out how to provide a natural gas playing surface indoors. That's the issue. You got indoor stadiums are saying, well, you can't do grass indoors. Well, I guess you can. So that's going to be the other issue that we're going to get into with J.C. Tretter. Our second guest on the show is Desiree Hoffman on behalf of the United Auto Workers, UAW.org. Every time I talk about the UAW, I urge our listeners to go to the website and find out where the union-made, American-made cars are, and they always have an updated list. And if you're in the market for a new vehicle, check out UAW.org. That's a good service there on behalf of the UAW. A couple things we're going to get into. The nomination of Amy Coney Barrett to the Supreme Court to replace Ruth Bader Ginsburg. The timing on all this and the fact that we've got millions of people that are hurting right now. And it seems the Senate Republicans, this is all they care about, getting her on the bench and not helping all those people. The latest on Trump is apparently steroids have an effect. If you have ever been on steroids or you know somebody that's on steroids, you know they are not of sound mind. And yesterday we reported on the show that Trump tabled all the negotiations between the House and the Senate on added stimulus. In other words, a scaled-down HEROES Act, something that passed in the House back in, what was it, May 15th, and nothing's been done. Well, apparently, I don't know if he was feeling the pressure, but he changed his mind and he's now thinking, well, maybe we should do something. All right. Well, if you can figure out this president, you're a better person than I am. No doubt about that. So we'll get into all of that with Desiree Hoffman as our second guest right here on America's Workforce. The AFL-CIO's Death on the Job report came out this week. We got a statement here from Rich Trumka, who is president of the AFL-CIO, and he said the report shows the tremendous neglect by the Trump administration since day one in office to ensure that working people are safe on the job. Now listen to this. As the COVID-19 pandemic continues to spread, affecting more than 7.4 million Americans, with more than 210,000 deaths just in the United States, the AFL-CIO report contains data showing how the current administration's failure to act in the past has been the main contributor to the gravity of the current public health crisis. The AFL-CIO outlined the current health crisis as a product of the Trump administration's regulatory rollbacks, weakened regulations, and resource cuts to the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, better known as OSHA. Now, according to the 29th edition of the report, in 2018, 5,250 working people were killed on the job, and an estimated 95,000 died from occupational diseases. Now, each and every day, on average, 275 U.S. workers die from hazardous working conditions. The job fatality rate remained the same as the previous year, 3.5 per 100,000 workers, indicating little progress on making workplaces safer in recent years. The toll and burden of occupational injuries and illnesses continue to be enormous. And despite the findings, OSHA's meager resources keep declining. Currently, federal OSHA has only 746 inspectors, the lowest number in the history of the agency. And the agency goes back to, what, 1970? So the Labor Federation is coming out saying, we have some problems in America. They need to be fixed, and they need to be fixed right away. Death on the job. If you go to the AFL-CIO website, you can get some more information, AFLCIO.org. There's another thing. There's some videos posted on there as well. And there's also something to activate union brothers and sisters. Go to this website, workersfirstvoteunion.org. It's time to hold lawmakers accountable. Vote on November 3rd, or even better, mail in your ballot and stay safe. You can get all the details there. WorkersFirstVoteUnion.org. WorkersFirstVoteUnion.org. Amazon announced via a blog post, this happened last week, that nearly 20,000 of its workers contracted the coronavirus between March 1st and September 19th. Now, Amazon contended that their infection rate was lower than those in the general public because of the company's various workplace protections. However, you know there's more to this. Infectious disease experts interviewed by Bloomberg have said that the information Amazon released doesn't paint a complete picture. This is because the state-by-state employee data neither answers whether the infection rate at the company's facilities is improving or getting worse, or if there have been any wide outbreaks at individual facilities. In addition, it's difficult for employees and experts alike to determine whether the company is adequately meeting workplace safety benchmarks, since there have been few such companies releasing such data. That's the problem right now. They're keeping it pretty quiet. And one more here. The nation's top union of registered nurses, whose 190,000 members are on the front lines of battling to save lives during the pandemic, is urging everyone to stay vigilant against the plague, despite President Trump's reckless response to catching the virus himself. Bonnie Castillo is the executive director of National Nurses United. She's an RN. She added Trump's refusal to wear a mask once he returned to the White House from hospitalization for the virus is, quote, reckless, irresponsible behavior that ignores the right of White House workers, including his own staff, to a safe workplace without their boss walking around shedding a virus that killed over 200,000 people. Trump's actions after his three-day stay at the Walter Reed Military Medical Center in Bethesda, Maryland, were of a piece with his prior reaction to the pandemic. Denial, refusal to take safety measures such as mask wearing and social distancing, and demanding the economy and schools reopen. Virus be damned. He also again declared the flu is more dangerous. Comment here from Jean Ross. She's the co-president of the Nurses United Union. It appears the president learned nothing from contracting the virus himself and how his flaunting of public health measures led to him defiantly and irresponsibly taking off the mask, exposed people around Trump. We call the United States to stay the course on COVID-19 precautions. Wear your mask, socially distance, wash your hands, and follow the example set by nurses, even though the president is not. Big salute there to National Nurses United. Close to 200 members of that union have died as a result of COVID-19. All right, we have to break. You're listening to America's Workforce. Our segment with J.C. Treader. He's a Cleveland Brown, and he's president of the NFL Players Association, exclusively right here on America's Workforce. Don't go away.
This is America's Workforce. More shows available at awfradio.com.
LIUNA, the Laborers International Union of North America, is the most progressive, aggressive, and fastest-growing union of construction workers, and one of the most diverse and effective unions representing public service employees. LIUNA members are on the forefront of the construction industry, a sector that is a powerhouse of 12 million workers producing 5% of our country's economic output. A half million strong. We're united through collective bargaining agreements which help us earn family-supporting pay, good benefits, and the opportunity for advancement and better lives. With Mobile Action LIUNA, you can get updates on your cell phone, find out how to sign petitions, and download union ringtones. Be a part of your union's political and organizing efforts by sending a text message on your cell phone with the word LIUNA to the number 69866. Through the LIUNA Action Network, you can stay informed about your union with a one-minute update and action alerts.
The United Steelworkers of America represent over 70,000 workers in the state of Ohio. Steelworker members enjoy the benefits of some of the best contracts of any workers in the world. Many of your friends, neighbors, and relatives are members of one of the most effective democratic unions in our country. With the pressures unorganized workers are under in today's economy, you need to join them. So call the Steelworkers Organizing Office at 216-292-5683 or toll free at 1-800-443-3752.
Now, back to America's Workforce. Here's Ed Flash Ferens.
Hey, we're back. It's America's Workforce, where we are available on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, iHeartRadio, as well as Spotify. Also on Facebook and Twitter. Twitter handle is AWF Union Podcast. AWF Union Podcast. Let's go to our live line and join J.C. Treader, center for the Cleveland Browns. He did play for Green Bay, and he grew up just outside Buffalo. Now, you grew up, there's an Akron, Ohio. We all know about Akron, Ohio. Used to be the rubber capital of the world. And there's an Akron, New York. JC, is that right? And welcome to the show. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me on. That's correct. So I grew up in Akron, New York, small town, you know, about 120 in your graduating class in high school. It was a great little town to grow up in.
So were you always into football? Were you a football standout in high school and college and all that? Give me that story.
Yeah, I was. I played two sports, football and basketball. I probably, in my mind, I think I was better at basketball, but I stopped growing at 6'4", and that pushes you directly into football when you stop growing. So ended up going to Cornell to play football.
Uh-huh. Now, I understand you were thinking about becoming a sports agent. Was that in college at that time or what?
Yeah, so I went to Cornell in their School of Industrial Labor Relations. And there you see a lot of guys go to law school, human resources, or getting involved in unions. So originally I went to that school thinking I would eventually go to law school, and then I wanted to, with sports being such a big part of my life, I wanted to stay involved in that world, and I thought being a sports agent would be the way to go. And then as things developed, changed positions, moved to offensive line, got bigger, and luckily I've been able to stay involved in sports more heavily, being able to continue playing and getting drafted to the NFL.
Mm-hmm. Now, do you have a union background in your family? Anybody kind of push you into the unions?
No, I actually, my dad works as he's retired now, but he worked as a VP of a trucking company, and my mom works as a school business administrator for my high school. So obviously they have involvements with the union, but usually on the other side of the bargaining table. And I think just my time at Cornell, the industrial labor relations schooling, you take a lot of classes, a lot of things with about unionism and unionizing, and it was something that I didn't have a lot of background in growing up, but once I went to school, I really started to enjoy it.
Yeah, I'm just wondering if that kind of opened your eyes, since you didn't have that union background growing up. You probably saw a different side of America, right?
Absolutely. I can't say enough good things about that program at Cornell and the work they do. And, like you said, it was eye-opening, and it was a great experience.
What, was it very difficult in school? I mean, that's a top-notch school. I was just wondering how difficult that was for you.
Yeah, I always think I give a lot of credit to any student-athlete going through the rigors of a college experience, as well as managing to play at a high level on the field and all the work that has to go into that as well. I give a lot of credit to all athletes across all sports for all the work they have to do. So it's always it's always time consuming and a lot of work to kind of stay on top of both of those jobs you really have, your job of being a full-time student, and then your job of performing highly when you get onto the field or the court or whatever sport you're playing.
All right, let's get into the Players Association. I know you started off with Green Bay. Did you get involved in the union back then when you played with the Packers?
So we had a longtime union rep, Jordy Nelson, great player, even better person. And he always did a great job of leading our locker room. Early on in my career, I went through some injuries, broke both my legs, one my rookie year, one my second year. And a lot of the time I was just, trying to make sure that I was going to continue to be a professional football player, and putting the time in and making sure I put my, my career first of getting, my feet under me, literally, and getting back from these injuries. And once that continued, I got to the point after 4 years, I left in free agency and came to Cleveland. And I felt good about where I was in my career, about how I prepare for games, how I prepare during the off season. And I felt like I wanted to get more involved with the PA and do more. And I was elected as one of the alternate reps for the Browns. And then this past off season was elected president of the NFLPA in March.
Now, was there some competition for that top position as president of the Players Association?
Yeah, there was three people that ran, me and two others, two members of the executive committee from the previous year, and it was honestly a really neat experience. It was kind of my first time ever running for like an elected position, and you go and you give kind of a 5 to 10 minute speech in front of all the players. We have a once a year meeting with all the team's reps. Comes down to we were in Key Biscayne, Florida for our rep meeting, and all the team and their representatives are there, and you give a speech in front of all of them, and then we break out and do like 5 or 6 rooms, and there's about 5 or 6 teams in each room with their reps, and you go in, it's just 20 minutes of Q&A, and they can ask you any questions and just want to see how you're going to represent them, how you're going to fight for them. And you go through that, and then it goes to the vote. Like I said, it was a really, really neat experience, first time going through it. And obviously, I'm very happy to be elected and be able to represent everybody.
So you were elected in March of this year, and immediately, I imagine, the job consumed you at first. Maybe we could speak to that part as far as what you had to do to be the president of the NFL Players Association. I mean, you're representing a lot of football players here. There's a lot of issues, which we're going to discuss in the second segment here. I know you're concerned about the artificial turf that's out there and safety out there. And plus, we're in the middle of a pandemic. Let's remember that as well. But what was the first thing that you had? I guess the best word I could use is tackle, right? Go ahead.
Yeah, so when I got elected, the ballots were out for our new collective bargaining agreement. So the previous executive committee and the previous president had negotiated our new CBA, and everybody was voting. So I took the job, understanding that I didn't know whether the CBA would be ratified or not. And then it was about, I think, like a 3 or 4 day wait until the votes were officially cast and, polled, and we figured out that the CBA would be officially passed. So you think it, kind of quiet down for a little bit, but, that's right the same time that COVID really hit the country hard and the world hard. And that brought up a bunch of things that I don't think anybody would be prepared for, would expect. And we ended up having to almost negotiate a couple mini CBAs this off season. We had to make big changes to our normal off-season program, what that usually looks like, the practices. And when we were in full-scale lockdowns across the country, you can't come together as a team, and figuring out what that looks like, how to protect players both for their safety as well for their salaries and for their bonuses. And then you get to the season and you have to almost renegotiate a full one-year CBA on how everything will work this year. Again, how to keep people safe, how to protect the financial aspects of our contracts, and how to get everybody back in the building. So it was a unique experience. I'm sure everybody in all industries went through and are still going through on how to best protect the membership during a worldwide pandemic.
Yeah. You think about that. I mean, you signed a 10-year contract, and then you get hit with a pandemic, something that hadn't happened for 100 years. I mean, that had to be mind-blowing just for you to deal with this situation. That being said, I mean, you kind of touched on this. Maybe you can elaborate a little bit more. The fact that you had a signed contract and you had specifics in there, and then all of a sudden the pandemic comes. Was there pushback from management to say, well, wait a minute, we got a signed deal here. We can't change this kind of stuff. Did that kind of thing happen?
No. So the big issues, one, the health and safety of our players, that's been a non-negotiable for us. And obviously when you start talking about a virus that's transmitted from person to person, and it's a contact disease and we play a contact sport. The health and safety aspect is big, but you have to come to some sort of agreement on how management is going to keep the workers safe. And then that's their job, is to provide workers a safe work environment. So we were always going to hold them to that standard. And then the interesting thing about The financial aspect of it is there's, you know, we had a true up negotiated into our CBA where if we project revenue for the next year, and if we bring in more revenue than expected, the salary cap will go up more. If we bring in less revenue than expected, the salary cap will obviously go down. And that's how our CBA works. And once we realize this COVID's going on and there's going to be potentially no fans at any game, we understood there was going to be a significant hit in the revenue. And we didn't go into this year thinking there was going to be a worldwide pandemic. So that wasn't, you know, projected that way. So both sides, I think, were motivated to come to some sort of agreement on how to handle the financials, because as players, we don't want to see the salary cap dip, because that would mean a lot of us either have to restructure or get fired. And the teams who have spent years building the rosters to compete for championships don't want to have all that hard work thrown out and every team have to start with a full rebuild because the salary cap's cratered. So I think both sides were understanding that this has to be talked about, has to come to some sort of an agreement in order to get the season going.
Yeah. Sounds like things really, really work well for, you know, you. We might have to take your talents to various unions around, because it sounds like you're getting the job done, JC.
Well, I appreciate that. Like I said, it's, this was an odd year that you never know coming into a new position, what your job's going to look like, what your role is going to be.
Right.
And I think this year, especially, you know, going through these negotiations and going through these conversations and trying to figure out what's best for the members. This was a unique challenge, because there's really nothing you can look back on. If you're negotiating a new CBA, you can look back at all the previous agreements, look back at, you know, what things worked, what things didn't. And this was a new, unique challenge that there's nothing really to look back on. It was about, you know, working with experts and trusting your gut and just doing what's best for your membership.
My hat's off to you, JC. Hey, you know what? I got to take a break. When we come back, I want to talk about the artificial turf. I know you're very outspoken on that. Could we do that in the next segment here, JC?
Sounds like a plan.
All right. JC Treader, center for the Cleveland Browns, also the president of the NFL Players Association, right here on America's Workforce. We'll continue the conversation right after this.
This is America's Workforce.
There is unity and strength for workers.
We are the USW.
We are the USW.
The United Steelworkers.
The largest industrial union in North America.
We represent 850,000 members in the U.S., Canada, and the Caribbean.
We work in metals,
rubber,
chemicals,
paper,
oil refining, atomic energy, and the service sector.
We are steelworkers, standing strong and fighting for what's right.
America's Workforce is being brought to you in part by the Communication Workers of America.
The United Auto Workers are one of the largest and most diverse unions in North America, with members in virtually every sector of the economy. Learn more about this proud sponsor of our program at UAW.org.
Hire union musicians. Call Music Talent of Cleveland at 216-881-1802. Call Music Talent of Cleveland as your dependable source for professional musicians in Northeast Ohio. Union musicians add harmony to weddings, elegance to parties, and uplifting music for all events. Music Talent of Cleveland contracts solo and ensemble musicians, as well as bands and orchestras for single engagements. So hire union musicians. Call Music Talent of Cleveland today. 216-881-1802.
Now, back to Ed Flash Ferens with America's Workforce.
And welcome back to America's Workforce, where we are available on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, iHeartRadio, Spotify. By the way, when you get a chance, just sign up for our shows on a regular basis, Monday through Friday. Give us a rating, and we would appreciate a 5-star rating. All right, let's go back to our live line. Rejoin JC Treader, who is the president of the NFL Players Association. We're talking about negotiating a contract in a pandemic. I mean, crazy stuff, and he was able to do it and make some changes to the contract because nobody expected to go through what we're going through. All right, the other issue, and I know about this issue for years because I remember back in my other radio days when I was working in rock radio, we had a lot of football players on the show, and they all complained about artificial turf. And and maybe something's going to be done about it. You spoke out about this recently, and apparently we've got some data now that we can kind of bank on to get some changes made. JC, talk to me about what's going to go on here. Are we going to go back to grass here, natural turf, or what?
That's our union's position, and we've looked at this. Like you said, we have data we've collected from 2012 to 2018, and it shows staggering injury numbers on the increased risk of playing on artificial turf versus natural grass, and both the increase in contact injuries, but also the increase in non-contact injuries, the increase in lower extremity injuries, knee injuries, foot and ankle injuries. Foot and ankle injuries are up 69% higher rate on turf than it is on grass. And those are serious injuries. And, you know, we've always looked at a player safety issue is player safety should never be tailored or pushed into just a player issue. It's a league-wide issue because obviously players don't want to be hurt. Players don't want to miss time. Coaches and GMs put these teams together and want their players out on the field playing. And it makes their job easier when everybody else is healthy. The owners, their biggest investment is us, the workers, the players, and they don't want guys to be missing time either. And the same thing with the fans who cheer their team on and are huge fans of the organization, but are fans of the players too and want to see their favorite players out there playing. And when data comes out like that and it's so staggering, so clear, you need to start looking at how we can, again, provide the safest work environment possible for our players.
Now, there's a couple of stadiums that are indoor that are actually using natural grass. I believe it's the Cardinals and the Raiders. So, I mean, I remember the conversation, if you're indoor, you can't have grass. So apparently that's not the case today, is it?
Right, yeah. I think, you know, any area can hold a natural grass field. And in Green Bay, Wisconsin, where I played for 4 years in frigid temperatures in the winter, has one of the best natural grass fields out there. Now sure. In Cleveland, the same thing, cold weather, and able to produce a really good natural grass field. And then you talk about the indoor stadiums. These new stadiums are being built with the ability to bring grass in on a tray and slide it into the stadium itself. And that's the thing. It's possible, and it's important to have grass because it's so much better for the players. And it won't be an easy push to convert the amount of stadiums we have that only have artificial turf right now. But it's clear that it's possible, and it's clear that it works. And that needs to be a continued push from all parties to push for natural grass.
So where are we right now with this? Now that we have the data, I guess we didn't have that before. I would admit, is this something for a collective bargaining agreement type of thing? Is this something that the players collectively have to say, hey, you know what? I'm tired of getting injured. I want natural gas. Or is it a combination of everything here?
I think it's a combination of everything. And it starts in a couple of ways. The NFL and the NFLPA have kind of designed specs of how grass responds. And we've given those specs to the artificial turf manufacturers to tell them to go and figure out a way to get artificial turf to respond the way grass does. And that would be great if that's possible. It's tough to just put all your eggs in one basket and figure out, you know, hope that just works eventually. The other side of the argument is finding better ways to test surfaces. And right now we use the Clegg test on both grass and artificial turf to test for safety, but that's pretty much just a hardness test, and it doesn't really do anything testing for performance or for safety. So we think we need to totally revamp the styles of tests we use to test fields to make sure we're, for the fields that are currently being used, we're only allowing the best fields to be played on. And then along with that is the push to just, instead of going through all this, push for a natural grass field in every location, because right now we know that's the safest way to play.
Yeah, yeah. All right, we got a couple of minutes left. I know you've got a lot on your plate here. I'm just wondering, am I missing anything? Anything you want to call attention to? I mean, you got, what, 6-7 months under your belt here as player rep for the Players Association, president, I should say, not rep, but president of the Players Association. Anything on the agenda here between now and the end of the year? I know you're in the middle of the season. You're having a pretty, so far, the season's working pretty well. I mean, anything else you want to add, JC?
Yeah, I think just harping on the player safety aspect, and that's something that I was very passionate about when running for this position, was my interest in making the game safer for generations to come and for the guys playing today. And we've seen it in two different issues that we've talked about today, the first being the issue of grass fields, and that's kind of the classic definition of player safety that we think about. And that's kind of between the white lines, what can we do to make the game safer? And then you go back, and this year kind of took a different definition of player safety with everything going on with the pandemic. Player safety moved to kind of the safety of people off the field and the safety of their families, and the importance of always fighting for that, and trying to keep everybody safe, and not only keep them safe, but give them options. And when we went through that negotiations, our main fight was making sure guys had a choice to play or not to play. If they didn't feel comfortable in the environment of playing in the middle of a pandemic, giving them outs to protect their rights and protect their contracts if they felt uncomfortable with it. So I think, you know, a priority of mine is always player safety, and our unions is always player safety. And it's just interesting what I've seen in my first, you know, kind of half a year in this position is how player safety comes up in a bunch of different ways, but it's all equally important.
And how long are you president of the Players Association? What's the duration of time?
Two-year terms.
Two-year? Okay. All right, my friend. Well, it sounds like you got a good head on your shoulders. We appreciate you in Cleveland, Ohio. You know, you know you're with a legendary team. You know, this is Jim Brown's home. You know that, JC, don't you?
Oh, I do. Absolutely.
Well, we are lucky to have you, and the NFL Players Association is very lucky. You got a great education there at Cornell. And two words, union strong, brother. All right? You keep up the fight and stay safe, all right?
Absolutely. I appreciate you having me on.
That was fun. J.C. Treader, center for the Cleveland Browns and president of the NFL Players Association, right here on America's Workforce. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, Desiree Hoffman on behalf of the United Auto Workers coming up next. Back in a few minutes. Don't go away.
You're listening to America's Workforce with Ed Flash Ferens.
LIUNA, the Laborers International Union of North America, is the most progressive, aggressive, and fastest-growing union of construction workers, and one of the most diverse and effective unions representing public service employees. LIUNA members are on the forefront of the construction industry, a sector that is a powerhouse of 12 million workers producing 5% of our country's economic output, a half million strong. We're united through collective bargaining agreements which help us earn family-supporting pay, good benefits, and the opportunity for advancement and better lives. With Mobile Action LIUNA, you can get updates on your cell phone, find out how to sign petitions, and download union ringtones. Be a part of your union's political and organizing efforts by sending a text message on your cell phone with the word LIUNA to the number 69866. Through the LIUNA Action Network, you can stay informed about your union with a one-minute update and action alerts.
The Food and Drug Administration has recently reported that the heartburn medication Zantac is linked to cancer. Zantac has been linked to a variety of cancers, which include bladder, colorectal, kidney, liver, pancreatic, and stomach. So if you or a loved one took Zantac and developed any of these types of cancer, you need to call Kelly and Ferraro, 216-575-0777. Let me repeat that number, 216-575-0777 for a free case review. You may be entitled to compensation from the drug manufacturer.
Now, back to America's Workforce. Here's Ed Flash Ferens.
Hey, we're back. It's America's Workforce. And don't forget, we are available on various platforms. That includes Apple Podcasts, iHeartRadio, Spotify, as well as Google Podcasts. When you get a chance, sign up and receive our shows on a regular basis and eventually give us a rating. We would appreciate a 5-star rating eventually. Okay. Let's go to line number 2. Welcome back to the show. Desiree Hoffman on behalf of the United Auto Workers, UAW.org is her website. And we're here to talk about the nomination of Amy Coney Barrett to the Supreme Court. Also, are we going to see any stimulus? But the big story from last night is the debate, the vice presidential debate between Mike Pence and Kamala Harris. Desiree, welcome back to the show. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
What's your takeaway from last night's debate? What do you think?
Well, it was a far cry from the presidential debate. You know, they actually had some sound arguments and policy approaches on various issues. And I think Kamala came out very strong. She frequently talked about how a Biden-Kamala Harris administration would look in contrast to the Pence-Trump administration. She came out swinging hard on the lack of a coordinated federal response on COVID. She talked about health care and what's at stake with the Supreme Court case that's coming up, California v. U.S. And she really held her own. And, you know, unlike Biden, I really think that Pence, you know, to give him some credit, is a sound debater and is very poised and eloquent. Don't agree with his policy positions, but he definitely is a stronger, much stronger debater than his boss.
Yeah.
That's my personal opinion here.
At least there was some civility compared to the debate between President Trump and Joe Biden from last week. So we'll see if the next one happens with the president now, the fact that he has COVID-19. Moving on to the judicial nominees, I know this is a big concern to the UAW, to all unions, and a lot of Americans. The polling indicates that they want to wait till after the election, and they want stimulus money. Instead, you got Mitch McConnell saying, oh, no, we have to start the confirmation hearings. Where's the UAW on this issue, Desiree?
Thank you for asking about that. You know, within hours of the death of Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, we see Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell putting out statements that they're going to figure out who the next justice to the Supreme Court will be. She was a trailblazer on so many levels. She's known for her work on women's rights issues, but she was an equal supporter of labor rights and civil rights. So we really lost a true hero and legal mind on the Supreme Court. So, you know, quickly we realized that one of President Trump's litmus tests would be someone who would invalidate the Affordable Care Act. And, you know, on his short list was Amy Coney Barrett. Amy Coney Barrett was a professor at the University of Notre Dame. She clerked for Supreme Court Justice Scalia. She was also, nominated to be on the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals in 2017, and she was confirmed. And remember, this court is based out of Chicago, Illinois, and it covers Indiana, Wisconsin, and Illinois. So lots of cases going through there when it comes to workers' rights and other key issues. And so since she's been confirmed to the Seventh Circuit, she's been on that short list for quite some time. She's basically made a lot of statements about where she stands on the ACA, basically saying that, you know, under the Roberts Court, they've already heard the ACA several occasions now, in 2012 and 2015, and they upheld the ACA during those times. But right after the elections, the Supreme Court is set to hear yet another case on the ACA. And if the Supreme Court invalidates it, we could see healthcare coverage stripped from more than 23 million Americans. And you were mentioning pre-existing conditions at one point. 135 million people with pre-existing conditions could lose these vital consumer protections. And I think it's important to remember what a pre-existing condition is. It's diabetes. It's asthma. It's pregnancy. So if you've had a cesarean section, those are pre-existing conditions. And in fact, COVID-19, because a lot of people have had lingering healthcare issues as a result of COVID, that could be deemed a pre-existing condition.
Desiree, talking about COVID-19, think about the long-term effects. We don't know what's going to happen to the people that did get the virus down the road. We're hearing brain damage, lung damage. I mean, it could be permanent. Then again, that's going to complicate things. And if you don't have health care, what are you going to do? The other part of this, you have heard this, so have I, that, and Trump has said it several times, that they're going to come up with a better health plan.
Right.
Have you heard of anything on your end about a better health plan than the Affordable Care Act?
No, and quite frankly, they've tried to, you know, the Republicans over the years, you know, they tried to repeal or replace the ACA over 70 or 100 times now, and they don't have anything to replace it. So when they say that, they are actually, you know, it's a fib. It's they would fall short dramatically on a comprehensive healthcare system that has all these consumer protections, has a coverage. It's covered millions more Americans, and so they don't have a plan.
No, not at all. So you think McConnell is going to push this through? Then, yeah. What's your gut telling you right now?
So yeah. So timing wise, you know, right now things are really up in the air. But as we speak, you know, there's going to be Senate Judiciary confirmation hearings in the committee scheduled for next week. Then it's likely to be on the floor right before the election. So sometime in the next couple of weeks, I think right before Halloween. And what we're saying amongst other allies like Leadership Conference on Civil Rights and Alliance for Justice and other organizations working on this is slow down. This should not be happening in an election year. In fact, there's tons of hypocrisy around this. If you remember, so no Supreme Court justice in history has ever been confirmed later than July of an election year. In 2016, Senate Republicans refused to give Merrick Garland a hearing when Justice Scalia died just 9 months before Election Day, asserting that the American people should decide who should select his replacement. So, you know, and also there's a lot of research and polling out there right now that the Senate process just weeks before the election, it's unsupported by a majority of Americans, Republicans and Democrats. They think that the next Supreme Court justice should be nominated by whoever is elected president and then should go through the Senate confirmation process. So
yeah,
this is a very hypocritical point of view right now. And so it's on very uncertain times. It seems like this judicial nomination will move forward.
Yeah, I got a announcement from a group of small business owners. I guess they polled thousands of small business owners around the country, and 79%, so that's what, almost 4 out of 5, believe Congress should prioritize economic relief over debating a Supreme Court nominee. I mean, think about all the businesses that are hurting right now. We've got millions of people that are out of work. Some of those jobs will never come back. And instead, Mitch McConnell is focused on the Supreme Court. Now, Trump said no stimulus is going to happen until after the election. He said that earlier yesterday. Then in another tweet, he said, oh, no, we're going to get back together and come up with something. I don't know. The guy's doing steroids. We don't know what's going to come out of his mouth. That being said, what's happening in Congress? Are they going to get together here on something? What are you hearing?
Right. So the primary negotiators over the last several months have been Speaker Pelosi and Treasury Secretary Mnuchin. McConnell's kind of been off there talking to his caucus, but those have been the primary, and also Senator Schumer. And so, like you said, there's been tons of flip-flopping with the president, and we're not really sure where he stands. One minute he's saying, while he's at Walter Reed, get back to the table, make America great again, and negotiate a COVID package via tweet. And then a couple days later or a couple hours later, he's saying, no, we're not negotiating a package. All is off. We're not doing anything before the election. And now we're hearing from him again saying, let's do some airline stimulus, let's maybe do a separate standalone economic stimulus bill. So it's very confusing times, and the American people deserve more than that. They deserve they don't deserve this on off again negotiation. Their lives are at stake. Their economic and health is at stake. We see now over 200,000. Kamala kept saying this, and this is right. This is accurate information. 200,000 deaths in the U.S. related to COVID. We have 7-point-something million cases of COVID in the United States. There's been no coordinated response. And she kept emphasizing if we had a, you know, a Harris-Biden administration, we would see things like an OSHA temporary standard where every workplace would have an infectious disease plan. We'd have, you know, PPE, personal protective equipment for everyone. We'd have national guidance on how communities should navigate the pandemic and resources for small businesses and families and testing and tracing. We'd have so many things that have been sorely lacking under this administration. And, you know, one thing I should mention about the negotiation, too, is last Thursday, Pelosi decided to scale back HEROES. So she scaled it back to a smaller package, and it was designed really to bring the White House back to the negotiating table. And that's really when negotiations started back up. And then we saw the flip-flopping back and forth. I don't know what's going to happen here in the next couple of weeks, but Speaker Pelosi has said she's going to bring back her caucus if negotiations bear some fruit. But what's at stake right now is we need unemployment insurance, $600. We need that. We need stimulus money for families who are struggling to make ends meet, paying their bills and their mortgages and trying to buy groceries. We need state and local government aid. State and local governments, red and blue states, are experiencing financial worry and revenue crunches. And we really need to make sure that they have help because there's an increased, well, a lot of their constituents are saying, hey, I need help. I need health care. I need whatever vital services. You know, we really, really support that. And, you know, we can't, this is going to be a prolonged economic recession from all indicators. A lot of workers, in fact, you know, have been unemployed. There's about 30 million workers now receiving unemployment. And a lot of the workers that, you know, this hasn't been brought up in the news a lot, are long-term unemployed. And that becomes very problematic when you have discouraged workers who are unemployed for 6 or 7 months or longer, because it's harder to get back into the workforce. So that's very alarming in itself. And I think we're going to see a lot more about that in the coming months. So we really need stimulus now. It's very dangerous to let this continue.
The sad part about this, Desiree, you're seeing Nancy Pelosi scaling down, trying to negotiate. And the other side, the Republicans led by Mitch McConnell, don't want to budge. And you know this from experience in Congress, you need compromise. And don't you get the feeling they just don't want to compromise? You get that feeling?
Unfortunately, yes. You know, they have an agenda. You know, they also have said over and over again that they want to include things like liability lawsuits to protect businesses and workplaces from lawsuits that may come their way as a result of COVID exposure. So that continues to be an area that they disagree on. The biggest areas of disagreement are that state and local government funding that I mentioned. You know, President Trump referred to it as bailouts for blue states who don't know how to manage their money. But in reality, all states are trying to figure out how to pull themselves out of this mess. And, you know, this is very uncharted territory, and we need to be supportive of these states who are trying to provide critical services and frontline workers, you know, who are taking out the trash, essential workers, police, firefighters. So we really need to make sure that's happening.
Yeah. The states are doing the job that the federal government should be doing. It's very unfortunate. We're going to leave it on that note. Desiree, thank you for your contribution to the show and the sponsorship of the UAW. You take care. Be safe. Tell Josh Nassar I said hello. All right.
Most definitely. Thank you. We'll talk again soon then.
You got it. Desiree Hoffman on behalf of the United Auto Workers. UAW.org is their website. That's it for another edition of America's Workforce. Tomorrow, the latest from the progressive populist, labor lawyer Joyce Goldstein, and we talk about fighting wage theft. Until then, all of you have a safe and wonderful day.
That concludes another episode of the America's Workforce Radio Podcast. Thanks for listening. and be sure to subscribe so you never miss a show. America's Workforce is a production of Labor Tools and BMA Media Group. Find out more information online at labortools.com.